That's the Honorable Mr. Neal. When you're ready, please come on up. Mr. Neal, the Honorable Mr. Neal, if you're ready, just a moment.
Chief, very nice.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, I'll take care of it.
I don't have a list, so.
Just give me one second. We don't have everybody on the list. It's on the list that we have.
Mr. Pryor, you on the phone yet, sir?
Yes, I am, sir.
Okay, well, just hold on. Honorable Mr. Neal will be conducting a hearing in just a moment, sir.
Yes, sir.
So, you're Elizabeth?
I am.
And you represent Mr. Pryor?
No, I am a prosecutor at the Maricopa County Attorney's Office representing the state.
Can we kind of get the two of you to reverse? We apologize.
Please, to see me.
Everybody want to have a hard time knowing this way.
So, Mr. Quinn, you represent Mr. Pryor?
Yes.
You're in Maricopa County Attorney's Office. Are there any other supporters here for Mr. Pryor? Any other victims representatives?
There is a victim representative here, yes.
Then are you going to speak, Mr. Quinn?
Yes.
Okay.
Get it all in order before we get going here. And Mr. Pryor, you're in. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can, sir.
Maybe that might be a little better. But we have a lot of audio and visual difficulties recently, so if anybody has time to hear him, please speak up as we go so we don't miss anything. Mr. Pryor is on the phone with us right now. Correct, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay, we have a representative for Mr. Pryor in the room, and a representative from Maricopa County Attorney's Office, and as well as the victim's advocate today. So, this hearing is for Mr. Pryor, who is 71, almost 72 years old, and he's serving a 15-year sentence for attempt to commit sexual conduct with a minor, which began on January 3rd, 2007. His sentence is consecutive to another 15-year sentence for attempt sexual conduct with a minor that began on January 4th, 1992. Mr. Pryor was certified for this hearing on March 16, 2018, for regular parole acid discharge. He has appeared before the board over 3 times with May 10th of 2017 being the last hearing, in the 9th time. Okay, I'm going to give a little summary about Mr. Pryor, and then we'll make sure that everything seems to be correct as far as the information I have, and then we'll have a chance to discuss your case and your situation and hear from your attorney and from the Maricopa County Attorney's Office and the victim's advocate. Okay, sir? Mr. Pratt?
Yes, sir.
Can you hear that?
I can hear you, sir.
Okay, I'm going to go over some information, summary of your incarceration and the offense. We'll hear from you will have an opportunity to talk to us, and then we'll hear from your representative and the victim's representative in Maricopa County Attorney's Office. Okay, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay, as I go over the information, we'll just about verify it as often I'm getting it correct. So it seems that you have some pretty good programming. The majority of it looks to be from Central Arizona Community College. It was very high, it's a good college, but it's very commendable that you got a program. And I see you have a package of certificates from there. and some more information. I just got it this morning, so if I miss any information, please feel free to tell me.
Yes, sir.
And here at present, and then we don't have a whole lot, well, we're not going to be returning here as far as victim support. There's, I know there's some issues, court issues as to what do you, you know, how the kind of contact that you have with your, the remaining with family, money, other than the victim. Then, previous victim responses are very adamantly afraid that, that you will be released. Those are from 2014 and 2016. I didn't see any current ones. There was opposition letter from the Maricopa County Attorney's Office dated May 7, 2018, as well as a representative here today. Is that about correct so far, sir?
Sir?
Does that sound about correct with what I just said, sir?
Yeah, it pretty much sounds correct. I'm a little hard of hearing. In the,
okay, I'll,
in the, yes.
I'll speak up a little bit more. The, also, I note that you have prostate cancer and you're receiving treatment for that.
That's correct, sir.
Overall, you have a failing health. You have, I see that you have a 100% disability award from the Veterans Association Administration.
And that's correct, sir.
Yeah, currently, you only drawing 10% of it, but that's because you're incarcerated as soon as you get out and prove that you're released up at the full, which is a pretty healthy sum of over $3,000 a month. So, income isn't an issue when you're not being able to support yourself. And then, at your age, you should qualify, if you did 40 quarters of work, you should qualify for Social Security also. Okay, and we're really planning to stay when you get out, sir?
I was thinking of being released to Penal Reentry Center. That's at 1275 Boulevard, Tucson, Arizona. At which time I would probably contact the real estate agent to see if I could get a rent to own or something like that home.
Okay. Have you put in an application with anybody or talked to your CFP about placement at NYC?
Say again, sir?
Have you talked to your CEO or made any formal arrangements to be placed in NRC?
I still don't understand that, sir. I with the airport, it's hard for me to understand, but I've been trying to contact every and other places also. I've contacted like Step House in Glendale, Arizona, and they sent me a letter as long as I'm not done. Let's see what it says here. It says, as long as I'm not posted for public notice, you know, sex offender posted for public notice, as long they'll go ahead and accept me. And they have a program there that, it's a program that you have to do so many hours of service every week. You must complete 20 hours community service weekly. This is a workers' program. That's another one that I've been looking into on as well.
Okay, well, with MRC, you have to, that room is placed by parole office. And you have to, you know, initial placement there, we still got, they have no room to there for anything. So that's why I'm saying, have you actually put in any applications or talked to your CO3 about how to get placed there properly, DMRC? Have you?
I haven't talked to CO3. I just got the letter recently back, as you say, from the Steps House.
Okay, well, I'm talking about MRC. You have to do the same thing with them. You have to go through your CO3 and the probation officer, the parole officer. You have to make pre-arrangements. It's, you know, if you're out on release and your PO decides you need a sanction, go to MRC, but it's still set the dates based on your availability. So it's one of the things that needs to be kind of in place. Same thing with the step house. whatever issue we run into, it's not going to be a problem to you, is that the usual department question wants to make sure we do that. And that one, the account for financing the cover of 2 months worth of rent, you obviously have that with your savings and everything else that you have going for you there. So that's not an issue, but placement is.
Whichever my office wants to place me, I'll be willing to go and abide by whatever rules they set forth.
Okay, I'm gonna go over very briefly the information on your office, and then we're gonna talk about everything starting right up to today. Okay, sir? The offense was basically what it boiled down to was between the ages of 4 and I believe it was 14. There was a continuous molestation of your daughter, which included many different things. And then in the sentencing, there were a lot of charges, and you keep clear agreement to eliminate most of them, and that was for 2 and 15 year consecutive sentences for attempted sexual contact with a minor, and the third sentence was to be a lifetime probation.
And,
I'm not sure about your sex offender classification as to public notice or how it is. I'm pretty certain you're running for the minor territory representative might be able to shed some light on that. Okay, sir, I know you've been in front of the board several times, and I believe those that are going today has had an opportunity to talk with you and discuss your case the last time you were here. Spend a whole lot of time going over the offense because we have done what you said before. But tell us what was going on in your life back then with my previous getting this kind of activity. And the reason I'm asking that now is so that you can go on and tell us a little bit more about what you've done since you've been incarcerated to get yourself ready so that you can reintegrate with society. Okay, sir?
Repeat that, sir.
Okay, I'd like you to start with that when this offense started, when your daughter was born. With what was going on in your life and your mind and why you might have got involved in that. And then from there, kind of tell us what you've done since you've been incarcerated to make yourself ready to be able to go back out into society and in a society where you don't have to worry about being reoffending.
Well, I've been keeping, well aware of the current events out there. I've been doing my investments with T. Rowe Price. I've been trying to study books as much as I could in different areas. I wrote the Philadelphia Sex Institute to Dr. Berlin, trying to get information from him. I did have a letter from him. I couldn't find it. I would include it in the package. I could still find it and send it to you. So I've been trying to do some contact forms there,
Okay, well, let's go back to the original part of my question. What was going on in your mind and life back when you committed this offense?
I've tried to reanalyze myself many times over, what's wrong with what I've done. I'm a different person these days, but I had 5 kids. I guess my mind just went for some unknown reason. If I could somehow take everything back, I would. If I could even apologize, I would. I wish there was some way I could undo it. But I have to move forward right now and see if I could make life better for people that meet and everything else.
Okay, so you really don't know why you got yourself in that situation? Or why you did it for 10 years?
When I was down, and my mind hasn't been the same since. I had to relearn walking. I used to shuffle around with my left foot, dragging everything else, like a semi-stroke I had.
When was that, sir?
Huh?
When was that stroke?
Yes, in county jail. My mind just completely snapped back then.
Okay.
I think my attorney can explain a little bit more.
Okay, so you were in county jail for these charges?
No, I don't blame nobody. It's my fault.
All you said is you had stroke when you were in county jail. Okay.
Yeah, a lot of my memory was affected.
Okay, when were you in county jail that you had the stroke? Was it while you were in county jail waiting for the trial and stuff?
That's correct.
Okay, that's all I was trying to pin down, not exactly.
Yeah, and it just, with the echo, it's hard for me to distinguish your voice there.
Is there less echo when I talk like that, sir?
Yes, but this is not better. Yes, sir.
Okay. Can everybody in the boardroom hear me okay if I do that? But turning that off, he's not getting quite as much echo. Okay.
I wear hearing aids, but the echo, just trying to make out the words that you're saying, so I'm not even understanding some of the things that you're asking me.
Okay, well, the echo is from the... we have one set of microphones that amplifies everything that you're on the speakerphone, so sometimes that's where that echo was coming from.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so I want to ask you a couple of questions
yes, sir.
About your cancer, if you don't mind. That's your right to not tell us anything about it because it is a health issue, but if you don't mind, so you've got... prostate cancer, what is the prognosis on that?
It's ongoing right now. What they're doing right now with the shots I get every 90 days, it's a technically a chemical castration. My testosterone has to be kept down because that cancer feeds on the testosterone. So I have zero sexual urges or anything like that. In fact, if you look at the award from the VA, it talks about that I have erectile dysfunction, as you say, because of my treatment there. I think it's page 3 of the, page 2 and 3, it talks about it.
That's one of the That's one of the complications of prostate cancer and...
That's correct, sir.
But what are they saying about the long term for you, your overall health, what it's going to do to your overall health and your longevity?
I don't know. They haven't really told me. They just said I have to stay on that, otherwise I'll come back.
Okay, so they're with the shots and everything, they're saying it is currently in remission?
It's holding it down. The shots, in other words, there's no testosterone in my body at all. Okay, so as you say, it's holding the cancer from coming back right now.
Okay.
If you read the medication, I'm supposed to stay on it for life.
Right, as long as you're in remission, as long as you're taking the medication.
That's correct.
Okay. And what does that do to your ability to get around and to do other daily functions?
I can walk okay because I push a wheelchair in here. I can help people, I can do things. I can survive. I can cook for myself. I'm not handicapped in that, the farm or anything like that. I cannot do any kind of sexual activity because I don't have no urges whatsoever. I could not even attempt to do it. Period.
Okay. So, What, you know, I mean, are you going to, when you say going to help people, what kind of activities? I know you don't need the financial aspect of it.
No, I just I've always been a worker. When I was out on the street, I moved people, you know, I did estimates, things like that. And I've always liked associating with people in that respect, you know, in any way I could help them. In fact, I moved to Shepherd, as you say, from the downtown area to 16th Street in Ochicott. I've been the local move for J.D. Hayward. Okay, I've been in his house many a times.
Okay, well,
I like to work there. I don't mind doing community service and things like that.
Okay.
Just a person lives longer if he stays active. If he's not active, you know, then he pass away.
It's always good to stay active.
I'm not
sure if there are any questions from my fellow board members at this time. Mr. Johnson.
Good morning, sir. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir, I can.
Okay. So I'm just going through the file, going over some information. I know that you said that you were involved in sexual relationships with your daughter from the time she was 14.
Can you repeat what you just said?
Sir, according to the information that we have in the report, going through some of the information, you admitted to being involved in a sexual relationship with your daughter from the time she was 14?
That's correct, sir.
Okay. And she alleges that... He admitted that he was involved in a sexual relationship.
What started it for?
Well, I know that.
Okay.
Let me finish. So, according to your daughter alleges that you were involved in a sexual relationship from the time that she was born. Is that right?
Let me correct this, sir. I used to be a truck driver. I drove on a truck, and we didn't settle down in Glendale, Arizona until she was a school age. My wife and me were in a sleeper, and she would be sleeping with her brother on the front seat. So this got occurred out early. And if you, I think that my attorney has to copy of the lie detector test that will confirm what I'm just saying right here. So that she's off on that age bracket area.
Okay. All right, so what age bracket would you put it in, sir?
Well, the touching, I think, started somewhere around 7 or 8.
Okay. All right. And then, sir, there's a couple of letters over the years that your daughter has written, and in one of the letters she states that you have threatened and pointed a gun at her and her mother.
That's incorrect. I was cleaning my weapon at that one time, right? It was totally empty, and she walked in on me. It was angled in that direction, but it wasn't pointed at her.
Okay, so did you ever make any threats to her and her mother?
Never. I'll take a lie detector test on that, then I'll pay for it.
Okay, then it says that also after you were incarcerated, you made several attempts to contact her or to other family members, is that right?
No, that's incorrect.
Okay, did you make any attempt to contact her?
The only thing that I have to do is contact my ex-wife to get my, find out where my birth certificate was, my citizenship papers and things like that. And that was, then I had to take it to court, and the judge ordered her to return it to me, and she still did not return it to me.
Okay. So, just so that I can be clear, can you, your daughter alleges, just so that I can be clear on the time period, your daughter alleges that it occurred from the time that she was four, and you state that it was from the time she was 7?
I took extensive, as you say, lie detector test by Dr. Gray, and he'll confirm my account in a little closer accurate than what she's saying right now.
Okay. Okay, so when at the time, we don't have a police report, so we're not trying to retry. I'm just trying to get a clear understanding of the time frame of when it occurred. They say that originally you stated that it occurred with
Someone. Nothing happened in the semi because my wife was with me. I'd go in a little furniture and she would take inventory, and the kids would watch TV inside the semi. Yeah. And then when she got school age, I settled them down in Glendale, and I still went back on the road. I did not come back until she was about close to 7 years old. Then I started working locally at the Roadrunner truck stop, loading and unloading trucks. My wife did not work. She was a stay-at-home person at all times because she did not drive. Anywhere that she had to go, I had to transport her. She did not get a license until, I would say, closer to 86.
Okay.
So until then, she was a stay-at-home mom.
So I know that you have extensive programs, sir. What type of sexual modification classes have you had since you've been incarcerated?
Say again, sir?
What type of sexual modification programs have you taken since you've been incarcerated?
The only programs that I've taken, as you say, well, in here, is, let me find this. Okay, I took college courses. I took, as you say, cognitive restructuring. I've taken, as you say, to medical being showed, as you say, what to do and what not to do with inmates. Oh, here it is. I took diabetes education in 2007. I took cognitive thinking for change 2009. I took institutional food prep 2006. I have a total of 24 college credits accumulated. As you say, the exhibit part of my thing that they brought is all certificates I earned.
So have you taken any sexual modification classes since you've been in program, since you've been incarcerated, that would help you discover what the triggers are or what caused you to have that impact or relationship that you've gone through over those years?
No, I haven't taken no sexual classes while in here, but as I was telling the other gentleman, I am technically right now chemically castrated. I have no sexual urges whatsoever, or anything like that. And the paperwork there, if you read it, will show that.
And that's because of the prostate cancer?
Huh?
And that's because of the prostate cancer, you said?
Yeah, that's part of the prostate cancer. The chemicals that I take, it chemically castrates me because it removes all testosterone from my body whatsoever. Normally, a man has runs of testosterone around, PSA score usually is run about 5, 2, 4. Right now, I'm at 0.006.
Okay.
My PSA score.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Any other questions? Mr. Quinones.
Thank you, Mr. Neal. Mr. Pryor, can you hear me clearly?
Yes, I hear you. It just echoes what...
I'm going to turn off the microphone and see if I can just use my voice to project to avoid the echo.
Okay, yes.
Is this any clearer now?
A little bit clearer, yes, sir.
Are you getting echo?
No, right now I am hearing you clear.
Okay, I'm going to just have to speak loud. I have a question for you.
Yes, sir.
Considering the trauma that you caused your daughter,
yes, sir.
And I would hope that she's living a well-adjusted life now, but my guess would be that she's emotionally injured for the rest of her life. What do you think would have been appropriate punishment for you? What do you think?
The incarceration has been done already, sir. I think that is also punishing me with a prostate cancer and diabetes, which was caused by Agent Orange. I'm being punished as well, besides, you know, everything else. If I could pay for any further treatment for my daughter, I would pay for it right now. Whatever conference she needs, I'm willing to pay for. If she needs advanced counseling, you know, I will pay for any of it.
Thank you, sir. I have no further questions.
Yeah. Hello?
Yeah, I have no further questions, sir. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm just not the same person, you know. I'm willing to do whatever amends need to be done to make things right again.
Okay, sir. I don't know. It's with my experience with I've been a victim to a heinous crime that sometimes amends are totally unable to happen because the trauma can't be reversed and people don't always forget. But I think Mr. Canonis' question was more, what do you think a sentence put out by the state would be as punishment? The state, you know, the people who are really, we can't dish out things like cancer or, you know, health or anything else like that. We, you know, the laws are pretty clear that you get sentenced to prison for a certain amount of time. And so I think the question was, what do you think would be a fair sentence in jail for what you did?
Well, the judge enhanced the, as you say, my
sir,
sentence.
Sir,
the judge enhanced my sentence because I got a little bit more than the... Hello?
Sir, what do you think? Not what the judge thinks, not what the judge did, not what the victims think. What do you think would be or should have been the appropriate punishment as far as incarceration for you for the offense you committed? Okay, so pretty much what you've already served.
That's correct, sir.
Okay, thank you for the clarification, sir. I think at this time, unless there's any more questions from the board, I'm going to defer to your attorney, let him speak and present your side, and then we'll go from there, okay, sir?
Good, thank you, sir.
Would you step up to the podium, please? State your name and...
Josh Cooner, COOMER. Members of the board, we're here once again on the parole hearing of Tad Pry. He became eligible for parole, I believe, 11 years ago. In talking with Mr. Pry, he's not really articulating the same things that he talked to me about. I'm not trying to be a witness, but what I'm trying to do is to better explain to this board what has gone on since he's been incarcerated, okay? As this board knows, there's two prongs to whether the board should grant a parole. One, there's a substantial likelihood it's going to be law-abiding, and two, it's in the best interest of the state. Mr. Pry understands the heinous nature of what he did, and he can't take that back. He can only move forward. And looking what he's done moving forward, I think there's evidence to show that he is and he has tried to be a better man. He's tried to take all the classes he could. He's remained employed throughout his time in jail. But more importantly, he's only had two minor infractions the entire time that he's been incarcerated, the last of which being in 2006, 12 years ago, just by having a sewing needle that was previously permitted, and then policy had changed. The there was the allegation that he did try and reach out to the victim, but there's no evidence to say that's the case. He was obligated through his divorce in the early to mid-90s to reach out to his other children to let them know, to try and help them out and to let his wife know what financial, not responsibilities, but what finances he had at the time that they could have access to. That's the only communication, I believe, that has been attempted or made. It wasn't to the victim, it was to his ex-wife. Also, in terms of, let's go to the second problem. It's in the best interest of the state. We've got a gentleman who's in failing health. He's 71 years old. He's been incarcerated for 26 years. He has prostate cancer, diabetes, cataracts, and a whole host of other ailments. And if released, he would become the responsibility of the VA for his further medical care, not the state. So dollars and cents, and unfortunately that's part of the what needs to be weighed here, he would be less of a burden to the state if released. So then, being that being the case, going back to the first problem, will he remain law-abiding? And I'm not seeing that there's much of anything here to show that he wouldn't be law-abiding. That means an elderly gentleman who will probably just serve the rest of his days until he passes away alone, without family, because of what he's done. And he understands that. He realizes that. He can't take that back. I've got a section in what I presented that he's got a plan for when he is eventually released. He's got finances to be independent. So I'm not sure that should be a consideration for the board. I'm just a little sure I haven't missed anything. As there's not evidence to show it, as his history has shown the last 26 years, that he's been a model inmate there at the prison, and has, though he didn't need to, has worked, not only worked, but worked in areas where he could help others. I think the facts in this case lend towards granting him parole this time.
Thank you. Any questions from the board?
Yes, I believe that, sir, thank you so very much for being here this morning and speaking on behalf of I believe that he was asked this question. I'm going to ask you. You may not know, but why these many years that he's been incarcerated, that he's not had any sexual programming whatsoever? I believe when Mr. Johnson asked that question, he said that he had not. And that's not a requirement, but that's something that the board always liked to look at, and to see what the triggers were at the time of the offense and so forth. There's any particular reason you think that he is not? I know he gave the reason, if I'm assuming correct, that it's not necessarily because of his health situation, but in the past he was able to bypass that, sir.
Mr. Pryor can speak to this, of course, better, but it's my understanding that several attempts were made to get him involved in the class, but for various reasons it never came to pass. I think what he's talking about now is it necessary for him to do the class now? He doesn't believe it is, because he doesn't have sexual urges because of the medication he's taking. But Mr. Pryor will have to attest to why, when the past when he sought those classes, that he was not able to participate or promote those classes.
And may I just ask this, sir, how long have you represented him, sir?
Our firm has represented him for the last year. I've been in this case the last 2 weeks. So.
But your firm has been with it for the past year?
Yes, yes. I believe in our brief, Your Honor, we mentioned that he has attempted to take the classes, but he has not been able to participate.
Thank you so very much, sir. Thank you, Honorable.
Thank you, sir. We, I know that there was paperwork that says that he was, has never been allowed to take the SOECP, but you said that he doesn't think it's necessary at this point in time?
I think that's what he's trying to say now, is to, if I had taken the class and things were figured out, which he hasn't done, I think he's trying to explain to the board that he's even in a better position not to have sexual urges because of the medication. I don't believe he's trying to say that he couldn't have benefited from that class had it been worked out that he was able to take the class.
Okay. Well, I don't believe any more questions. Do you have anything else you'd like to present at this time? But after you go through the victim's statement, you'll have an opportunity to make a final statement, or one or both of you can make a final statement before we make a decision, okay?
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Would the victim's representative like to speak now and let the county attorney do the last?
Okay, thank you.
My name is Jacqueline Moody, and I'm reading a letter from the victim, Sabrina Crowley. I'm with the Department of Corrections Victim Advocate. Before I read the letter, I just wanted to provide the board with some information that we confirmed after the beginning of the hearing about the halfway houses and Department of Corrections, and this is just kind of for the record, it can be confirmed later. But because the inmate is a registered and notifiable sex offender, we know that he will be, we know that now, he is not eligible to go in almost all of the halfway houses that he mentioned, except for there is one or two some he can go to, but the MRC and those other ones that he mentioned, he cannot go to us because of that reason. And this was written on April 23rd of 2018, even though there's many similarities from prior letters, it's a recent letter. My name is Sabrina Pry. I am Tad Pry's victim. I was sexually, physically, and mentally abused by Tad Pry my entire young life. My entire childhood is filled with memories of the horrible, sick things he would do to me. The abuse happened daily and at times lasted hours, so I would beg for him to stop. I would cry that it hurt, and he would just say that he was not done yet. School was hard because I knew at the end of the school day I would come, then I would have to go home, and he would make me change into something easy for him to remove and force himself on me. He would also make me inform all sex on him, and this was every day. I remember even before I started kindergarten having to touch his penis. Him touching my private areas, and this was daily. He would finger me when he was holding me or sitting on his lap. Any opportunity he had to violate me, he did, and this was routine, no different than brushing my teeth daily or watching cartoons. In my bed, he would try to push himself into me, and he told me that if I would just go to sleep, he would get it deeper and it wouldn't hurt. It consumed me every morning. As I got older, I would try to fight him off and beg him not to. He would sometimes bring a gun into my room, and he would point the gun at my head and then at his. He would ask me if he should kill himself, and I was so scared and afraid. One time he would hand me the gun and ask me to shoot him. He would often have the gun out just around the house. He would point the gun at my mom during the fights and even at my younger siblings, and we all lived on the edge. I often thought he was going to kill us all. My siblings, three brothers and one sister, all were physically abused by him. We were hit with his belt and would have welts. He would also take popcorn kernels and put them in a pan and make us kneel on them for hours. And when we finally stood up, we would have to pick the kernels out of our knees. He would also stand us facing the wall, and we would have to hold our arms to the side, and he would place gun belts in our hands. And if we lowered our arms, we would have to stand longer against the wall, and this would go on for hours. I could write thousands of pages of details of my sexual and physical abuse. It's emotional to write down even what I had in this letter. I remember being so young, being under 10, and thinking, why is this happening to me? I was so afraid that I would never be normal. And to this day, I suffer with severe anxiety, depression, and panic attacks as a direct result from the abuse he did to me. Over the years in prison, he has contacted family members only to discuss himself and how he is the victim. He had 5 young kids, and yet all with all the letters, he never asked how any of them were. Tad Pride in prison only still cares for himself. If he's released, he will be a threat to me, my siblings, and my mom. In one letter he wrote my mom in May of 2009, he writes, P.S. Life is hard when one is on their own. Everything costs, doesn't it? I know his thinking, his obsessive behavior, he will not stay away from us. He is violent. He has beat and pointed guns at me, my sibling, and my mom several times. He's dangerous. Please keep him in prison. He kept me in prison of sexual abuse my entire childhood. The longer he remains in prison, the longer I have at my freedom from him. Please see also all my letters to the board in the previous years. I'm begging you, I am scared of it, and please do not release Ted Fry. Sincerely, Sylvia Fry.
Questions?
Thank you.
Good morning, board members. Elizabeth Reamer, R-E-A-M-E-R. I'm the Deputy County Attorney at the Maricopa County Attorney's Office in the Sex Crimes Unit. If I may approach, I have a packet of letters for each one of you. I will note before I hand them out that the last letter is graphic in nature. It is something that the defendant sent to the victim. There are also letters in here that were sent from the defendant to his wife, his previous wife, the mother of the victim, the woman with whom he has 5 children. May I approach?
Thank you.
Oh, sorry about that.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. Sure. To the victim. The very first letter in that packet was sent to the victim's mother in 2003. We have confirmed with the victim that she did receive the drawing herself. It was sent directly to her. She's also received some letters
And there have been many, many, many more letters than the ones provided to you all today that have been sent to the victim's mother, related to the family, related to this case, etc. I will start with sort of the facts and circumstances. We are not here to retry the case, but obviously the facts of this case are important in the determination of what sentence is appropriate and whether the sentence the defendant has received is excessive in nature. As you know, the defendant is the victim's father. This abuse was in the home. This abuse was over a decade. This abuse was extreme. This abuse was sexually violent. And this abuse caused the victim, of course, emotional pain, but also extreme physical pain. The things that the defendant required to be inserted in the young victim's vagina were painful, were large, and are in part what has caused the level of damage that applies in this case. These acts were perpetrated on a very young girl for over a decade. That is why the defendant finds himself where he is. The sentence imposed was not clearly excessive, and the petition for commutation should not be sent to the governor. I will note that the defendant took a plea agreement in this case, which dismissed most of the 18 sexual abuse counts. The court advised the defendant of what would happen were he to go to trial. He made the decision to take the plea agreement, and that decision required him to admit a factual basis. So he was required to admit attempt to commit sex conduct with a minor on multiple different instances, which led to this sentence and the fact that the defendant will have to serve a lifetime probation tail upon release. That would suggest that the defendant has taken some accountability, some responsibility for his actions. And I would submit to the board that that is not actually the case. To say in a five-minute hearing that you did the things your lawyer said you did doesn't negate the years and years and years of continued terror that this defendant has subjected the family to. The letters submitted show that he is not taking responsibility for his actions. The letters, and one letter which is to the victim herself, you can tell because it says dear victim's name in it. It doesn't say victim's name, it says her name. But just for the record, so that I'm not putting that on the record, it blames her. It says that she's lying. It says that she's doing this, telling her story because she's vindictive. That is inconsistent, number one, with the defendant taking responsibility, and number two, with what he chooses to tell you today. The victim has been clear from the beginning that she was 5 years old when this abuse began, and that it went until she was almost 18 years old. To suggest that the defendant now changing his story from it started when she was 14 till kind of started when she was 7 is taking responsibility is something that I would disagree with. And that is a paramount factor in whether this person is likely to reoffend. The number one point that any sex offender treatment therapist will say is that if the therapy goer does not acknowledge or admit the totality of what they have done, the chances of them taking in the treatment, adjusting their behavior, acting out socially appropriately in a criminally appropriate way is almost non-existent. I will note for the record as well that at the time of the defendant's sentencing, the sentencing range for sexually abusing a child, the age of his daughter, was 15 to 25 years flat, and that crime of sex conduct with a minor required that the other counts be consecutive. So when we're looking at whether the sentence is too much, right, that's why we're here. We are in part looking at what the legislature has decided is appropriate. What the legislature has decided based on our community electing people is what is an appropriate punishment, and And I apologize. I said it shouldn't be sent to the governor. I understand that, the board today will make a decision about what should happen. So we are there now, essentially. And what the state is submitting to you is that the defendant should remain in custody for the following reasons. The legislature decided that these crimes are so serious. The fallout is so serious. The damage is so serious that they carved out a separate and distinct sentencing guideline only for sex crimes against children. There is also a separate and apart, in some ways, guideline for sex crimes against adults, but the sex crimes against children sentencing guideline is in a completely different area than any other type of crime. Why? Because of what you see before you today. Because the damage is extreme. It is lifelong. The terror does not subside merely because the perpetrator is behind bars. You got that sense from the victim's letter, not only today, but the letters that she has previously provided. There was a question asked or sort of posed broadly about the classification that the defendant will receive. That classification will be done essentially by the probation department right before his release. So that classification, as far as I understand it, has not yet been done. At the point that the release is imminent, they will make a determination of what is appropriate in terms of his classification. These letters show that the defendant continues to terrorize the family. And I will make this point a little bit later in my argument, but to give you a little bit of a preview, I make this point now because sex crimes are almost never about sex. What the defendant did to the victim is sexual in nature, sure. Is sexually traumatic, 100%. Will affect the victim and her sexuality for the rest of her life. But what this case is not just a case of a sexual touching. This is violent sexual acts perpetrated by a father on his daughter while completely terrorizing everyone in that home. I will refer you to what was on the top, the very first letter, and I know that you've all kind of perused through them, and so they're not probably in the order that I provided them. But there is a letter that starts, "Hi, Dorothy. Please pass this letter to my ex-wife, Debbie." I would ask that you pull that letter now. It has pages numbered on the bottom. It's one of the few letters that does. This is the letter that was sent by the defendant to be received by his ex-wife, the mother of the five children. Please turn to page 3. At the very bottom, the defendant writes, "Remember one other thing, Debbie. If I really wanted to find you, I got the money to do so. In fact, for all you know, I could have someone looking for you right now, or I may have someone that has found you and is keeping an eye on you till I get out. Anything is possible when it comes to money." The letter continues on, and I won't keep reading it because you all have it in front of you. But it shows the continued terror that this defendant is choosing to participate in, related not only to the victim, but also the mother of his children. At the time that the defendant was sentenced, the sentencing guidelines required 50% time, and at that point you could request to be released, I'll say on good behavior, early. If this crime were to be committed today, the requirement today is 85% of the sentence and not 50% of the sentence, which I mention only in the context of my argument to the board members about the legislature and what we as a society sort of think is appropriate punishment for crimes that are like these. But what we know is that the crimes can be broad. Sex conduct with a minor, that charge requires penetration of the vulva, which is the external genital lips. It does not require penetration of the vagina itself. It doesn't require that the penetration be by a penis. It can be by a penis, by a finger, by an object, anything. So there are a lot of ways in which a person could commit that crime. The legislature has deemed it so serious that it requires very serious
ramifications and sentences. Here, though, we have the worst possible ways in which those things, those crimes can be committed. Because they weren't just with a finger or a penis. Again, by dad. They're also with objects that were inserted into the child's vagina. We need to look at the facts of this case, not to reopen the investigation, not to go through the facts of the case from a determination of, you know, what a trial court would be determining, but because it matters in terms of what sentence is appropriate. And the state would submit to you that the sentence the defendant has received thus far is appropriate. The early release of him being released onto parole is not appropriate because of the facts of the case, because of the letters and the contact that I have provided, but also for many other reasons. One being the defendant's mental health. The state will note that mental health issues can appear on the face of them to be mitigating in many ways. But what the experience of a sex crimes prosecutor tells us is that mental health issues can make someone more can make someone more likely to sort of fall off the wagon. The information that has been provided shows that the defendant's psychological testing suggests he has an antisocial personality disorder. He is described as devious, manipulative, emotionally immature, and highly self-indulgent. He uses justifications and distortions to describe his behavior. When you put the mental health issues that the defendant appears not to be sort of taking on full force, with the idea that he is of the opinion he doesn't need sex offender treatment because he has prostate cancer and is on some medication, what you have before you is a recipe for disaster. And that disaster is another kid being sexually abused the way that he sexually abused his daughter. I will also note that physical health and the deterioration of it may on the face look like something that is mitigating. My experience is that people who present themselves as having physical disabilities are better perpetrators. I have a case on my caseload today with a man in a wheelchair who has one leg. And what he did is convince people to help him on and off public buses. Good Samaritans that wanted to help a man who has a disability, a physical disability, would come to him within arm's length, and this is multiple victims, help him in his capacity as someone in a wheelchair, and then he not only sexually abused these women, but stabbed one of them. That is not a unique circumstance as a prosecutor in sex crimes. We see people with physical disabilities that use that disability to make people think that they are safe, to make people think that the vulnerability is not in you as the Good Samaritan, but in the person who has a limited capacity. And so the state would submit that if you were going to release a man who is acknowledging to you he does not need sex offender treatment, even though he put baby toys in his child's vagina, what is likely to happen is reoffense. The defendant is of an age that also might be mitigating. And I would submit to you that we have plenty of grandfathers on the sex crimes caseload that abuse people day in and day out. Is he the same as someone that is 20? No, right? I'm not suggesting his age is irrelevant, but I would submit to you all that age doesn't make someone not sexually abusive. What makes someone sexually abusive is their deviant sexual behavior that is untreated, and that is what we have before us today. This state would submit that the schooling that the defendant talked to you about does not have any effect on whether he will reoffend. It is not correcting any behavior that led to the charges, the case that we are here on now. There appears to be no family support. There is no one here. No one has submitted letters as far as the state understands.
and would submit that one of the reasons that the defendant does not have family on his side is because he terrorizes his family. They are terrified of him. There doesn't sound like there is a plan for release, which is imperative in terms of the transition into society being seamless, being crime-free, being appropriate. The defendant would need a stable environment. The defendant will need immediate, intensive counseling. The stability of his release seems unclear at this point, since, as the victim advocate noted, many of the homes that the defendant was attempting to get into would not accept him based on these charges, and because he doesn't believe that any counseling that is sex-related is appropriate. I will also note that much of what the defendant has spoken about today, and what is often discussed in the letters provided, is finances. The defendant is making a big deal about the money that he has. What the victim in this case needed was a father. What she got was a sexual perpetrator who has a bank account. I would submit to the board that his finances may be helpful in some small ways, meaning he may be able to afford to receive some housing that maybe someone else can't afford. But at no time is this defendant saying he's going to use that financial resource to get him the help that he needs, because what he's indicated to you is that he doesn't need it. Many families have five children. They don't annually rape their children. To suggest to you all that because he had a lot of children and a family to take care of somehow justifies what happened in this case is a red flag. I would note on the point of the defendant being on medication for prostate cancer and the defendant's belief that he is no longer a risk because he has no sexual urges, a few things. Number one, sex crimes are very often not about sex. They are almost never about sex. I would submit to the board that putting a toy in a child's vagina is not sexual in nature. So to submit to the board that parole is appropriate now, that the sentencing was too harsh, because he believes himself to be chemically castrated, defeats the purpose and is a distraction from what actually matters, which is that the defendant has proven to us that he has a deviant sexual nature and that he is willing to act out on that with children. I have a case on my caseload today of a defendant who attempted to murder his victim, a woman that he knew, and attempted to rape her almost dead body, but could not get an erection. And so he raped her with a flaccid penis. Is that unusual in my experience as a sex crimes prosecutor for 5.5 years? No. In fact, it is more common than in like the normal society that sex offenders have an erectile dysfunction. I'm not sure that the science and the studies have explained why that is, but statistically, it is not so uncommon for a sex offender to have a sexual dysfunction, meaning that they have erectile dysfunction or some other sexual dysfunction, which is essentially what the defendant is telling you he has, which means to him that he will not reoffend. Grabbing someone's breasts does not require sexual function and often doesn't require sexual motivation. It is a sex crime, and there are times when sexual motivation matters, but to suggest that prostate medication equals this sexual deviance that exists will no longer be acted on does not follow. The most dangerous sex offender is an untreated one, and that is what we have before us. What the defendant told the pre-sentence report writer back when he was pending sentencing was that the victim was running around the house in suggestive clothing and that she was trying to seduce him. He told the pre-sentence report writer that he wants to be in the community to help other children, that he understands he needs therapy and has always been a responsible citizen, that he
also wanted to be able to help his other children through college. I would submit to the board that none of this makes any sense in terms of allowing the defendant to be released on parole. Number one, he's blaming the victim for being seductive. This abuse began when she was five. He admitted today in my brief for the first time that it began when she was seven. He says that he wants to get into the community to help other children, that he's always been responsible, and that he wants to help his children in other ways. None of that has come to fruition. The state believes that the facts of this case, the scenario associated with this case, the behavior of the defendant while he has been incarcerated, either in jail and sending some of these letters, or in prison, shows that this sentence is not clearly excessive. For that reason, the state asks that the defendant's request for parole be denied.
Any questions from the board?
Yes.
Yes.
Just one brief one, because that was pretty compelling. With respect that we're not retrying this case, and also with some understanding of the plea process, it would seem that he received two consecutive charges for attempt.
Yes.
So if it had been just sexual conduct with a minor, a dangerous crime against children,
yes,
what would have been the maximum sentence?
I'm sorry, let me grab my notes. The sentence range on a straight sex conduct with a minor at the time, sorry, I just had it. I think it's 15 to 25, mandatory stacked, mandatory flat, but let me confirm that. Yes, it would have been 15 to 25 years flat, meaning he would not be eligible for early release, of course, and consecutive to any other count, and there were a total of 18 counts.
So it's still 15 years?
It's a minimum of 15
years. Okay, minimum of 15 years.
And a maximum of 25.
25.
Yes.
Right. I appreciate that. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, if I may just follow up, the full sex conduct with a minor count, which would apply to molestation of a child as well, they're prison mandatory, and so often in terms of negotiating a plea agreement, obviously number one, the state has to give something, otherwise the defendant would never take a plea. We often will give the defendant an opportunity to plead to attempt sex conduct counts for a few reasons. Number one, it lowers the range of sentencing, which is something that we're giving in exchange for offering the plea. But the other big point that we often have in offering an attempt sex conduct plea is that attempts are probation eligible, and that's how we get to a place where a defendant could be placed on lifetime probation after sentencing. Were a defendant to go to trial only on sex conduct with a minor counts and were to be found guilty after trial, if there are a lot, the sentence can be very, very large, but there would be no opportunity under the law for the defendant to be placed on probation after the sentence is completed.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yes.
So, sometimes when you plead to the attempt, is that sometime also done to spare the victim and their family from an excruciating trial that they may have to go through?
Absolutely. And I apologize for insinuating that the reason that we offer plea agreements is to give the defendant something. Of course, one of our big considerations in a case like this is the well-being of the victim, the well-being of the family, and the added trauma that exists when a victim is required to get in front of a courtroom full of people that they don't know and talk about the worst things that could ever happen to anyone, you know, for 2 days, being cross-examined, etc. So we absolutely take into consideration what the victims want to see as a result, although at the end of the day, of course, the prosecutor decides what plea is provided, whether there is a plea, etc. But we do consider what the victim wants and also really how this will play out and what will happen, what trauma we will be forcing onto a victim by requiring a trial because we think it's such a heinous case, etc.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
OK.
Okay, well, Mr. Clyde, we're nearing the end of your hearing now.
Sir?
Yes?
Can I say something, please? I'm listening to all that.
Sir? Hang on.
Okay.
You have a chance in a minute, please.
Yes, sir.
Okay, we're nearing the end of your hearing now. The board is going to be going into discussion to make a determination in a few minutes. But after that, we might give you an opportunity to make a final statement. We ask that you don't repeat yourself and give us information that you prefer. If you would rather just have your attorney speak, that's fine also. But if you'd like to make a statement, you can also have your attorney wrap it up for you.
Okay, I would rather make a statement that our attorney wrap it up for me. What I was going to say is that I had a VA psychologist talk to me, okay, and I was going to read what he had to say. The examiner stated that you were very cooperative and sincere. There is no evidence of suicidal or homicidal ideation. There is no indication of impairment in basic activity of daily living. You were noted to be oriented to person, place, and time, and were able to recite your social security number backwards without an error. There is no gross memory loss in either short or long term. There is no evidence of obsessive or realistic behavior. Your rate and flow of speech was normal. You were noted to be quiet, poised, and calm. You were also noted to be reverent and logical. The examiner diagnosed you with post-traumatic stress disorder to include major depressive disorder related to your in-service stressors. The examiner provided a global assessment of functioning, GAF score of 61, which is indicative of some mild symptomatology. For your information, a GAF is a global assessment of functioning score. It is a clinician's report of an individual overall level of functioning with respect to psychology, social and occupational functioning. The rate overall function range from 1 to 100, with a 100 indicating superior function with no symptomatology. A 30% of the evaluation have been assigned with respect to your mild symptomatology, which are complaining of depression backbursts, poor concentration, sleep disturbance, anger outbursts, depression, anxiety, startled response, difficulty establishing and maintaining relationship, and detection related to your PTSD and major depressive disorder. And that was stated on, let's see, disabled, but the Veterans Affairs rating decision February 4, 2009.
Okay. Would you like to say anything else, or would you like to defer to your attorney at this time?
Well, something else is that the moment upon release, the parole officer had set up some kind of special treatment program if necessary, if he seen it was necessary for me to do it, and I would complete it completely while out there. And at this point, I'm willing to do whatever the board wants me to do. It's their decision. I'd like to, as you say, the letters that the county attorney was talking about, those were written in 92, 93, somewhere around there. I haven't had written a letter to my children in many, many, many years, you know, because my wife turned around and they filed a court order, they might give me a change of address. The one time that I was able to get some kind of forwarding addresses, I sent three letters in those three directions. None of them came back, so I don't know if I got to her or not. And that was in 2009. That's the only time I ever wrote since between 92, 93, and 2009. That's the only time.
Okay.
You know. That's all I can say. You know, I consider nothing more, really. And the way my attorney can show up for me, please.
Okay, thank you. Sir?
Board members, I realize, we all realize this is not a court of law. Rules of evidence don't necessarily apply. That being said, that's why we're not here to retry this case. A lot of time by the county was spent on things that occurred prior to sentencing.
Mr. Price that he wasn't at the ER. It's indicated the mental time through basically the first 2 years incarcerated until he finally said, you know what, this is my fault. I take full responsibility. I'm moving forward. I submit that I don't know what letters you're talking about, what letters you were handed. I wasn't given a copy, but I'm assuming they were letters that were mailed prior to sentencing. Is that correct?
I received them through a victim advocate.
Again, we're playing fast and loose with rules of evidence. We can't even attest to them. Didn't get copies, don't know what they're about. I would hope they would get little consideration. The county attorney said it was your job to determine that the sentence was too harsh. That's not your job. The court, the judge in this case, that was his job. These letters, probably, I wasn't there, it was many, many years ago, probably was given these letters. Hence why he received the maximum sentence of 15 years consecutive. There's not 25. He did get the max of 15. So to suggest otherwise, county attorney's just wrong. The key for this board is determined, again, two things. And in all due respect to the victim, and why we have to rehash what happened back there is just not relevant in terms of, will he remain law-abiding, and is it in the best interest of the state? Okay? So most of the things that the county attorney has brought up don't go to either of those two prongs. She was here to suggest that you were to decide whether he got the appropriate sentence, and that was for the judge to decide. With the rules of evidence and has the constitutional guarantees that, you know, blasphemous things are presented to this court. I mean, went so far as to compare it to three other cases that she has to attempt to sway this board to keep him in prison. There is no connection between those. And to bring those matters up in above this board is just inappropriate. It wouldn't stand for that in court. So again, what is this board is to decide, will he be law-abiding? I don't think there's anything to indicate that he won't. The connections, the letters, they were made while he was in jail before sentencing. The attempts made after were back in 2009. Now, the county said he could have helped his family, but he didn't. It's kind of like you have your cake and eat it too. He reached out to the family. He tried to be there in support of his other children. They wouldn't let him. Okay? And that's their problem. He did a horrible thing. He understands that. But there's, other than him not going through the sexual, the sex courses, which Mr. Pratt can attest better, but I believe that he has attempted multiple times. They've just been unavailable to him. I would ask that Mr. Pratt attest to this, but he has made many attempts to take those classes. They just have not been available to him, either because of their off-site or for some other reason. I do not know. But other than that, there's nothing here on the record to indicate that he would not be law-abiding and it wouldn't be in the best interest of the state to let him go. So for those reasons, I ask, and if this board denies parole once again, I would urge this board to explain to the defendant what he could do in this next year so this board would reconsider. Thank you.
Any questions from the board? No questions? Ms. Green?
We have a piece of information from the Ames database that we've been confirming Kosher, welcome to confirm it independently. In 1993, the inmate was beginning the sex offender treatment. I'm not sure exactly which program, but because he contacted the victim, he became ineligible, and so he didn't complete that programming.
Okay, thank you.
If that's a consideration, may Mr. Pry respond to that? And we're playing fast and loose with evidence, but I can't attest to any of this.
Okay, well, the way that information came out of the Department of Corrections record-keeping system, and, you know, when an inmate starts a class, it indicates that they started. When they ended, it indicates that they ended their training. Anything happens in between there, whether it be a discipline or anything else, it ends the training with the notation as to when it ended and why it ended. And according to that information, the contact with the victim that happened back in those days disqualified him at that time. So since 1993, though, he's had the opportunity to reapply, and he doesn't think he needs it, so that could be a very good reason why he might not have been qualified to get the training while he was in.
Do we know if that was the reason? I mean, he just said it shows he starts.
But that's the information that I got out of the Department of Corrections computer system is how she got that information.
Can Mr. Fry respond to it?
I don't mind that he replies, you know.
I would request that you let him reply.
Okay. Mr. Pry?
Yes, sir.
You understand what the discussion is at this time?
Sir?
Do you understand the discussion we're having at this time?
Yes, I do, sir.
Okay. So, would you like to respond to the information was presented that in 1993 you started one of the sex offender programs. We don't know exactly which one, but one of the sex offender ones.
And I think it was the one by Dr. Gray or whatever in the Stockton Institution area.
Well, according to the information in the Department of Corrections, that was all at the time that you sent that letter and got in trouble for making contact or attempting to contact the victim, and that's why you were disqualified from the class. So is that what happened?
That's probably what happened. There wasn't a victim. I wrote to my wife, and not the wife, my Crystal, my daughter, youngest daughter, and the oldest one, the victim, intercepted our letter. And
I have on my desk a letter written by you that's addressed to the victim. So,
I do know that the victim, in fact, if I look through my paperwork here somewhere, I could even send it to you. The victim turned around, wrote me one time, right? And she turned around and said, if I want to contact her, write a certain name. She actually initiated it.
Okay, well, let's go back to the sex offender classes. So
yes,
you attempted to take one, and for some reason you don't remember, it was terminated. And since then, you've decided you don't need to take any sex offender classes, so why haven't... When did you decide, because you haven't had the prostate cancer the entire time you've been...
When did you diagnose with the cancer? I was planning to take the sex offender treatment program until I found out that they chemically castrated me,
When did you find that out? When did you get the diagnosis that you were getting chemically castrated?
I'm looking for the paperwork,
Okay.
I don't have the data. I think it was 95, I'm not sure.
So 1995, you decided you did...
94, 95 was when you started me on the radiation treatment.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
No, 2014.
Okay.
Hello? 2014, 2015, I was taking radiation treatment. I was diagnosed with the prostate cancer at that point, and they told me what was going to happen when I started taking the treatment.
Okay. All right, thank you, sir.
Yes.
Mr. Is there anything else you'd like to add at this point in time?
No.
Okay, thank you. Are you asking for a rebuttal?
No, Judge. No, board member. I'm asking that I be given an opportunity to just clarify what I meant by the 25 years. Defense has suggested that the state misled the board members, and I want to make sure that I was clear as to what I meant by the max being 25 years when I was speaking to board member Quinones. So if I may.
Yes.
The defendant pled to attempted sex conduct with a minor. The defendant in this case pled to attempted sex conduct with a minor. My understanding in the conversation that I was having in answering the question from board member Quinones was about the sentencing range of a full attempted sex conduct with a minor count and a full sex conduct with a minor.
If I may, I actually asked a different question, and that was I understood the virtue of the plea process.
Yes.
The question was, what was the maximum for sexual conduct with a minor without the attempt?
Yes, and the maximum with sex conduct with a minor without the attempt is 25 years.
Okay. Per charge.
Per charge.
Sorry to interrupt.
Yes, per charge, and it's mandatory flat time, so you have to serve all of it and mandatory consecutive to any other count, regardless of whether it is another sex conduct count or a possession of marijuana count. And so I didn't want to leave the board to believe that the maximum the defendant could get under the plea was 25 years. It was not. The full counts, the charged counts, were a maximum of 25 years. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Pratt, the board is going to go into discussion. We're going to be talking amongst ourselves to make a determination of how to proceed with this. We ask that you stay on the line, but remain silent. If you think we're talking to you, we won't be. We're talking amongst ourselves about the case. But you can stay on the line. We're working on the open meeting law, so you're welcome to listen to the entire discussion. When we're done and have made a decision, I'll get back with you and we'll discuss the outcome, okay?
Thank you, sir.
All right, the board is now in discussion. This is a somewhat unusual case. It's unfortunate. It's very unfortunate for the victim. In looking at everything, I continue to get the impression that Mr. Pry is trying to do exactly what he thinks we're telling him he has to do, so that he can get a release. It's like he did, you know. I mean, it's good the certificates for his programming. It's very good that he put those in there because without them, he don't know about community colleges. But I also have a problem with his reiteration around he being chemically castrated, so that's going to prevent him from recidivism, and it's as explained by the county attorney's office, a lot of times the sex offender cases are not really about the sex, it's more about control. And I personally don't believe that the lack of physical function is going to completely eliminate the possibility he might reoffend. And I also have to bring up that his reading the evaluation from VA tends to lead me to the point of thinking that he may not be as predictable as he or his attorney would like to think. With PTSD, if flashbacks occur, who knows what's going on. And they did say that he's got PTSD stemming from his service. And it's the fact that it has to be weighed in there as to, you know, trying to decide whether he might reoffend. I also don't think that he really has taken responsibility completely for what he did, the depth of it, the scope of it, and everything else. It's always, it seems to pop around that issue about the he did this, he did it each time he gets a little bit further back and doesn't really take ownership of the entire situation with the offense. And it also seems to be put aside that he should be released from prison because he served his time, but his victim, until the day she dies, will never have served her time. I do hope, and I believe the entire board hopes, that she is living a productive life and being able to overcome all the emotional issues that this can cause. But at this time, I'm just not comfortable with the idea of releasing Mr. Pry to the community. But I'm going to listen to discussion from the rest of my fellow board members. Mr. Canones?
Thank you, sir. I just want to add that I'm disturbed that Mr. Pry considers his illness as part of his punishment in the context of his crimes, and that he suggests his alleged absence of sexual urges is somehow a cure for his propensity for violent sex crimes against children. And per remarks by Mr. Pry, it sounds like he would continue to write letters to his family if he could, but hadn't been, at least to my understanding, stopped by some sort of court order. So as one voting board member, I don't believe that he would abide by the law upon release, and I don't believe that community supervision would be in the interest of Arizona. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Any other comments? Mr. Johnson.
I have to agree. I do want to say that, just based on the information that we have in the pre-sentence report and the inconsistencies of the stories that he's actually been telling us, according to the victim, she was assaulted, started at age 4. In the pre-sentence report, Mr. Fry states that he did not engage in any sexual contact with her until she was 14 years old, and that between it was 14 and 16 that they had sexual involvement. And then today he stated that it started when she was 7 years old, that was very inconsistent. And then again they asked him about the had he taken any sex classes or been involved in any sex classes to understand what his triggers were or what caused him to perform those type of acts, and he stated that those programs weren't available to him and he didn't feel that he needed to take those classes. However, we subsequently find out, get information from the victim witness advocate that he did take one of those classes, that he was in a class in 1993. However, because he had wrote the letter, that he was disqualified from participating in those classes, that he's just been inconsistent. And very difficult to think that someone who's been that inconsistent would be not offended if he was back out there again. And then in the one of the letters that we have in our file from the victim, where she says she was scared of him being released and that he had tried to contact the family members by sending letters, and the tone of the letter was very evil, self-serving, and manipulative. She had a strong feeling that if he would be released, that he would harm the her and her mother if she was released. And I think that based on the information that we have, I believe that he would. And there's a good likelihood of possibility because he's had reached out and contacted the family in the letters that we have. And he, according to the letter that we have, our father, she wrote, she feels strongly that if released, he will harm her mother and herself, and he's dangerous, and that he had pointed guns at the victim, as well as her mom and her other siblings, stating that he's violent, and he has routinely beat the victim along with her mom and the other siblings that that she has. So I think that, you know, he was likely to offend, and then all of the, what alarms me the most, and all of the things that he says, and he's talking about that he has money and from Agent Orange and the STD, but and at no time did he really say prior to being questioned about it that he was going to seek any psychological, any sexual counseling, or any counseling that would help him figure out, you know, what caused him to do what he did. And he just kept being unlimited. And although we didn't have this letter before, that we were just presented with some of the letters, I think that in one of the letters he states that, and I used to refer to his son, he said, doing things he is safe to talk to me the way he wants, wrong. My arm is long enough for me to reach him from here. If he wants his nose broken, keep acting the way that he does, which kind of makes me think that he broke that young man's nose at some point, that he is a violent person, and that I think he would be a thing if he was released. And I think that family, it would be, is rightly so, and being fit for him, him being released. So I'm not in favor of supporting. I think it would not be in the best interest of the community, and I think that there's a likelihood, more of a likelihood, that he would reoffend than a likelihood that he would not reoffend. So I'm not supportive of him being given a parole to absolute discharge or home arrest, a regular parole.
Ms. Rittenhouse.
Mr. Rittenhouse, thank you. With respect to whether or not the, Mr. Pryor would reoffend, really two things, and one of them I agree with Mr. Johnson. But I would just add that I believe a person's acts originate as a thought in their mind, and that's not whether their body is capable of carrying it out. It's a thought. And I believe that Mr. Pryor is still capable of having thoughts, and he's indicated that to us today. This, my second concern is his extremely poor conceived release plan. He has nowhere to go. He may have money, but we don't have proof of that, and he has nowhere to go. So I would consider him not a good candidate for parole at this time.
Mr. Johnson.
So I also want to add that I'm not supportive of, you know, I'm a prostate cancer survivor myself, and I've undergone the radiation, and I know that there's different degrees of prostate cancer, but, you know, it does not necessarily mean that it leaves you sexually incompetent. And then really in these days and time and era, there's so many things that you can have done and get done that could relieve any sexual issues that you may have. So I just don't find that as being a deterrent for him to be out. I think, you know, him being out and having access to money gives him a greater capability of not being sexually incompetent. I think that it gives him a greater ability and opportunity to be able to do something to render that issue. So,
thank you.
It's been summed up quite well. I want to say at this point, I think that each board member has to make his or her decision based upon what the person has heard. This has been a long, extensive one, and it says relief in the best interest of the state of Arizona. As one board member, not speaking on behalf of the board, I do not believe that it would be in the best interest of the state of Arizona, as well as I don't believe that he would be a law-abiding citizen if he was released at this time. Thank you so very much, sir.
Thank you, sir. I do want to make one other comment before we move forward, and that's it's a little bit disingenuous, I think, to imply that the expense of taking care of Mr. Pry would be in the better interest of the state of Arizona just to dump it on to the VA.
I don't begrudge him his treatment. I don't begrudge the fact that he's going to be treated by the state or by the Veterans Administration, but I think it's a little disingenuous to relate that to a reason to release him from prison. So at this time, based on all the information that has been presented this morning and all of our discussions, I'm going to move to deny Mr. Pry regular parole or absolute discharge at this time, and the certification wasn't for the thing to us, so it just for parole or absolute discharge. So the motion is to deny Mr. Pry a regular parole or absolute discharge.
Mr. Neal, I'm showing you the
missing Dr. Omarasta. Really? I thought I was up there. I should have got it wrong.
Just got to make sure we have it correct.
She was certified for home arrest as well.
Pardon me?
I said he was certified for home arrest as well.
All three.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So it's my mouth on the sheet.
Oh, that sheet on the sheet on the sheet that.
Cover sheet?
The cover sheet from the department.
Okay, yeah. That would be on the tablet.
It's not there. It's
okay. So we'll do it this way. My motion is today. Road call after we discharge the home arrest for Mr. Pry at this time. And with the date of the offense, I guess we have to go back to the start date, which would that would not allow for a
form of service. I think it does, but I'm not sure.
Go back.
And
when he was charged with the offense?
September 1987.
To 87?
To January 1st, 1988.
Okay. We both qualify, so then that would go for when we're set up. And that would then also under the reasons after the
second.
Three. Yes.
Thank you. To Mr. Pryor, the board voted to deny your regular parole home arrest after discharge the time, and I'm going to go over the reasons at this point in time. It was a serious, and it would be violent to some extent, if there was serious and deviant offense, trauma to the victim, age of the victim. I'm going to put victim harassment, and not so much for the letters afterwards, but the conduct during the offenses. I'm going to put lack of programming, and that's because you haven't really gotten any sections in your classes in. And at this time, you have really no release plan because you're not qualified for the places you mentioned you wanted to go. There are no family or community support. Any other reasons that anybody else?
Mr. Neal, with the use of the weapon, showing the gun, would that be victim harassment? Or? Is there a place that should be?
I don't think there's one specific.
Probably just the victim harassment, though.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. All right, so, Mr. Pry, did you hear the reasons for the denial?
Well, the one thing I don't understand, the supposed harassment, the letter from 93. I'm not the same person that was here back in 93, and, you know, a lot of changes have occurred and everything else. Back then, I was still going through, you know, all kinds of mental issues and everything.
Okay, well, sir?
I haven't contacted her since.
Okay, but that's a very, actually, small part of this. The reasons of the offense, and at this point in time, it comes to, you know, poor release plan. But the materials are based on the offense, and that is always considered in these, no matter how long you've been incarcerated. And then we go into the more current things, which is like lack of programming because you haven't had any sex offender classes, and the no release plan because all the places you want to go won't accept you because of your status as a sex offender.
And well, Pima released a place to take me, I believe.
Well, there's only one in Tucson that we've been made aware of that would take you with the notifiable part. You can't go to MRC. So you have to have what you haven't had. You don't have any acceptance letters, anything like that to go. You don't have a place to go at this point.
Well, if that policy is the only one who sent the acceptance letter, and that's the one that said notifiable one, whether I'm notifiable or not, that was the step policy. That wasn't from me on
your status would be notifiable. So all those places you mentioned, with one in Tucson, that might take you, but you haven't supplied any acceptance letter. So you have no relief plan. And you have no family or community support. And as far as your mental health goes, you're talking about back then you had mental health issues that you've overcome. But according to what you read us from the VA examination, you still have mental issues. So that's something that could trigger problems. So unless there are other questions, sir, this is going to end your hearing. Okay?
Yes, sir.
Thank you for appearing, Dave. Would you please put the CO3 back on the phone?
Who?
The CO3, the person who's there.
CO3, yes, I will.
Okay.